Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 30th, 2010. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, pharma cuts back on development of new psychiatric drugs, the relationships among dopamine, impulsivity, and drug abuse, and we read from your letters to Science. All this, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Early this year, two big pharmaceutical companies announced significant cutbacks in their drug discovery efforts for disorders of the central nervous system, including schizophrenia, pain, depression, and other ailments. Those announcements have raised concerns about a possible broader pullback in the CNS drug area by Big Pharma. Science news writer Greg Miller covers the story in a feature in this week's issue. He spoke with me about it from his office in San Francisco.
There's a huge unmet need for better drugs to treat disorders like Alzheimer's disease and depression and schizophrenia. But there have been some worrying cutbacks lately in the pharmaceutical industry that have raised concerns. Back in February, GlaxoSmithKline announced that they were going to be cutting their drug discovery efforts for disorders including depression, anxiety, and pain. And then just a short time later, AstraZeneca announced that they would be cutting back on their efforts to find drugs to treat bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, and schizophrenia. Those cutbacks have really raised concerns for people who are worried about where the next generation of drugs to treat these disorders is going to come from.
It seems like there are an awful lot of treatments already out there for things like depression. What exactly is the shortfall in the current generation of drugs?
A lot of the current drugs that are on the market, particularly for depression, are chemical modifications of drugs that were actually discovered serendipitously back in the 50s and 60s. The pharmaceutical companies have been able to tweak those drugs, make chemical modifications that might lessen the side effects or make them a little more effective for people. But there hasn't been a real revolution in the treatment of psychiatric disorders in particular for quite some time. So there are a lot of drugs out there, and it's true that they seem to have been multiplying, but it's not necessarily true that these drugs represent a major step forward in the efficacy of treating those disorders.
So they're all kind of variations on the same theme, if you will.
Yeah, a lot of them are, and some of them literally are enantiomers, just sort of a mirror image of another compound that's already been improved. And it's not clear, as far as the brain and neurons are concerned, whether that kind of difference really makes much difference.
I guess that gets to a point that you make in your article, which is that the pipeline for these drugs to treat these neurological and psychiatric disorders really seems very full, but maybe not so much.
Exactly, and that's something that I thought was really interesting. There was a meeting recently at the Institute of Medicine that brought together leaders from academia and the National Institutes of Health and industry to try to take stock of this situation, and they commissioned a report that at least on first glance seems to show a remarkable explosion of the number of drugs in the pipeline for disorders like Alzheimer's disease and depression. For depression in particular, between 2003 and 2008, the group at Tufts University that did this report found that the number of drugs in the pipeline for depression more than quadrupled over that period, from 14 to 66. And that sounds like a great thing, but a number of people I talked to said that when you actually start looking closely at the list and seeing what drugs are on it, there aren't a whole lot of really new and exciting ideas there.
Well, this seems like such a potentially lucrative market. Why are these companies not pursuing it? Why are they suddenly shying away from it?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge market just based on the number of people worldwide that suffer from these disorders, and the chronic nature of the disorders suggests that there would be an absolutely enormous market. No one disputes that. But there are some reasons that developing drugs for disorders of the brain and central nervous system might be more difficult than developing drugs for other therapeutic areas. One issue is just the state of the science. There's disagreement about this, but there's at least a fairly widespread perception out there that maybe we just don't understand, particularly psychiatric disorders, we don't understand the underlying biology really well enough to have a very targeted, strategic approach to developing treatments. And just from a strictly business standpoint, this Tufts report that was presented at the Institute of Medicine meeting found that it costs something like $850 million to develop a drug for the central nervous system. That's more expensive than any other class of drugs. They take longer to get approved, and I think probably most strikingly, they have the lowest success rate. So only about 8% of the drugs that make it into clinical trials for disorders of the central nervous system end up being approved. If you're a pharmaceutical executive, that starts to look like a really expensive bet.
So there are sort of qualitative differences in risk between these drugs and maybe some other candidates. If these companies are cutting back on this kind of research, where are they going to put the money instead?
It's important to put this in the broader context of what's going on in the economy in general and in the pharmaceutical industry in particular. Almost everyone these days is facing a difficult economic environment, but for pharmaceutical companies, what they've seen over the last 5 or 10 years is the number of drug approvals is going down and the cost of doing research is going up. And not just that, they have all these blockbuster drugs, $1 billion a year drugs whose patents are expiring, which means they're going to be losing revenue because generic drugs are going to be competing with them. And so they're having to make cuts. It's not so much of a matter of taking the money from CNS drug discovery and investing it in something else. They're having to make cuts and looking at CNS perhaps as an area where the costs are high and the risks are high.
Well, that doesn't erase the need for innovation in this area. How do we get out of this dilemma?
That's a really hard question, and I think one we're going to be wrestling with for some time. The pharmaceutical company is looking at doing things like outsourcing their research and development, setting up labs in countries like India and China where the operational costs might be lower, trying to form contracts or arrangements with biotech companies and academic researchers to try to do some of the research that they previously would have done in-house. And at the Institute of Medicine meeting, there was also a lot of discussion about what role the National Institutes of Health might play in this. In the new healthcare legislation in the U.S., there's a provision for something called the Cures Acceleration Network, which would be aimed at speeding the development of new treatments, not just for central nervous system disorders, but across the board. But there's some thinking that if Congress decides to appropriate money for that, some of that money could then be used in this area. So that's one possible solution, but ultimately it's going to involve a number of different strategies, and we're just going to have to see how it all plays out.
Greg Miller, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Greg Miller explores cutbacks in drug development for central nervous system disorders in an article in this week's Science. A study published this week in Science casts new light on the links between brain chemistry, human impulsivity, and substance abuse. Here with more on the story is Science News reporter Dolly Krishnaswamy.
Everyone acts a little impulsively on occasion. For some, though, high levels of impulsivity, the psychological tendency to act without regard to potential consequences, can affect daily life and has even been tied to substance abuse. But what are the underlying brain mechanisms that control impulsivity and its effects? Neuroscientists Joshua Buchholz of Vanderbilt University and colleagues report this week in Science that the link is likely the regulation of a single common chemical in the brain.
We know from research in animals and in humans that the neurotransmitter dopamine, especially dopamine in a region of the brain called the striatum, plays a really important role in impulsive behavior. And we also know that dopamine is strongly involved in substance abuse, as all drugs of abuse change dopamine levels in the brain.
What hasn't been known is how differences in dopamine levels translate to differences in impulsivity, and whether dopamine is the biological key to the relationship between impulsivity and drug abuse.
This impulsivity is a very interesting trait.
Trevor Robbins is a neuroscientist at Cambridge University who is not associated with this study.
The question is, does it arise as a consequence of drug abuse or because the subjects were already impulsive before they indulged in drug abuse? So it's a chicken and egg question.
To help answer that question, Buchholz and colleagues developed a comprehensive model of what is known about dopamine's role in the brain and then tested it.
At the core of this model is an understanding of how the brain signals for dopamine to be released.
Dopamine-containing neurons are in the midbrain area, and some of these cells release dopamine onto the striatum, a region of the brain known to be involved in motivation and reward.
So when we experience something rewarding, like a really good piece of Swiss chocolate, or when we see something that we've learned predicts a reward, like the packaging on a really good piece of Swiss chocolate, these midbrain dopamine neurons get very active.
That is, they release more dopamine onto the striatum, triggering activity in this reward center of the brain. To keep the cells from flooding the striatum with too much dopamine, they rely on special regulatory sensors called D2 autoreceptors, which shut the flow down once they sense that dopamine has been released.
You can think of it in some ways as very similar to how a thermostat works in your house.
In this analogy, the autoreceptors are the thermostat that helps regulate how much heat is produced by the furnace, or in this case, how much dopamine is released from the midbrain neurons. It is this system that Buchholz believes regulates impulsivity.
To go with the thermostat analogy, we thought that these impulsive people had a broken thermostat, which caused their furnaces to pump too much heat into their living room.
Or too much dopamine onto the striatum. To test the hypothesis, the team first measured the impulsivity levels of volunteers using a standard questionnaire. Then, they used positron emission tomography, or PET scanning, to measure the presence of D2 autoreceptors in the same volunteer's midbrain dopamine neurons, using a tracer substance specifically tuned to bind to that receptor. Finally, they gave subjects the stimulant drug amphetamine, which should cause dopamine levels to rise, and used PET scanning to see how much dopamine was actually released onto the striatum in response to the drug. The result?
People with high levels of trait impulsivity showed lower levels of D2 autoreceptors in the dopaminergic midbrain.
That is, the experiments confirm that impulsivity was tied to Buchholz's broken thermostat in the brain. The results also showed that, when given the amphetamine, the subjects with the lowest midbrain D2 autoreceptor levels had the highest release of dopamine onto the striatum. And, says Buchholz,
after we gave our participants the drug, we asked them how much they wanted more of it. And we found that the people who released the most dopamine in the striatum had the strongest desire for more drug.
So this study has provided further evidence in high-impulsive, non-drug abusing human individuals that increased impulsivity is associated with increased dopamine.
Again, Trevor Robbins from Cambridge University.
And moreover, they've shown that this is correlated with a subjective wanting for the drug, which obviously suggests that these individuals might be at risk in some sense for abuse of psychomotor stimulant drugs.
So, in the chicken and egg debate, the new study suggests that the tendency to substance abuse behavior lies in a person's innate tendency to impulsivity, which in turn is linked to faulty regulation of dopamine in the midbrain. Buchholz thinks that the work could point to new targets for therapies aimed at tweaking the midbrain's dopamine regulation in highly impulsive individuals. And, says Cambridge's Robbins, the study suggests some other avenues for further research.
One interesting issue is the relationship to ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where, of course, impulsivity is a major symptom. So the relevance of that to this and the relevance of that risk in ADHD to drug abuse, I think, is of particular interest.
For Science, this is Dolly Krishnaswamy.
You can read the new paper by Buchholz and colleagues in this week's Science. Next, we read from your letters to Science. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
Our first letter this month comes from our July 16th issue and is in response to the March 5th Perspective article by Kluttenbrock and Sheldon on the scientific value of long-term ecological and behavior research. In their letter, Ronald R. Swaysgood of the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, along with two others, writes that this appreciation for long-term research needs to extend to actually funding it.
Long-term research has cumulative value that far exceeds its annual rate of return, the authors write. Sadly, quick empirical studies trump long-term research in the reward system for academic promotion in ecology and behavior. If long-term research is to flourish, we must build a reward system for studies characterized by deferred gratification.
The authors suggest that, for long-term field research to continue to contribute, it will require funding action on three fronts: adequately funding ongoing legacy projects, creating mechanisms to fund new programs with long-term potential, and, importantly, increasing support for ecological research generally.
We do not advocate robbing Peter, short-term research, to pay Paul, long-term research, say the authors. However, we maintain that Paul has already been robbed, and some balance needs to be restored.
You can read the letter in the July 16th issue.
Next, a Florida response to the oil spill crisis in the Gulf of Mexico.
In a letter in the July 23rd issue, Rachel N. Silverstein of the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science describes the uneasiness that has settled on the school as the spill has crept across the Gulf. "Although we are on Florida's eastern side," she writes, "the currents will likely carry the oil to our shores. What would become of the beach surrounding our campus and the reefs just offshore that we measure and map and monitor regularly?"
The answer, she says, is hard to predict. For example, she notes, the mucus layer of corals may allow them to slough off oil before it causes damage, but the more toxic dispersants used to clear the oil can dissolve the coral's mucus layer, which would allow chemicals to penetrate the tissues. And other stressors not related to the oil spill, coral bleaching, ocean acidification, disease outbreaks, and algal overgrowth, could make the coral still more vulnerable to toxic exposures.
Silverstein concludes, "Powerless, we wait and watch, trying to enjoy our beach, but always mindful of the days, perhaps not far off, when tar balls will mingle with the seaweed washed ashore. As we work to mitigate this disaster, we must go beyond a cleanup and demand better protection for these devastated and dwindling ecosystems."
You can find Silverstein's letter in the July 23rd issue.
Our last letter, from this week's issue, comes from José Antonio de la Peña of Mexico's Consejo Nacional de Ciencia y Tecnología and three colleagues from Mexico and Arizona, who decry the impact of the Arizona legislature's recently passed tough immigration law. They argue that the law will lead to the possibility of racial discrimination, and that apprehension about these effects is already being felt in Mexican colleges and universities.
Many Mexican faculty and students have expressed serious concerns about traveling to Arizona to work on collaborative projects, they note. And four Mexican universities so far have also canceled or placed on hold programs that required Mexican students to attend Arizona universities. Sadly, this means that innovative, collaborative programs in fields such as medicine, toxicology, and biotechnology are now in jeopardy.
The faculty and students that comprise an educational community, whether on a single university campus or across international borders, represent a social model built upon diversity of culture, ethnicity, and ideas, De La Peña and his colleagues conclude. As faculty and students of Mexico and the universities of the state of Arizona, we must continue to work hard to celebrate the richness of the diversity of our border, work across fiscal and cultural boundaries, and strive to better our ways of life. We will continue to work in a collaborative spirit, which is the hallmark of all great societies.
You can read the full letter in the July 30th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Stuart.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. Finally today, our usual wrap-up of interesting stories from our daily news site. Science News reporter Lauren Shankman talks with online news editor David Grimm.
So, Dave, what's the first story you've brought for us today?
Well, Lauren, this first story is about a sort of mind meld that happens when two people talk to each other.
So what do you mean by mind meld?
We're not talking about a Vulcan mind meld here. We're talking about how people's brains synchronize with each other when they talk. This is a theory that's been going around among psychologists. And the old theory about conversation used to be, you know, if I'm talking to you and you're listening, then only the listening parts of your brain are active and only the talking parts of my brain brain are active. But recently, psychologists have thought that's too simple a picture. They think something a lot more complex is going on. They say, you know, when people talk to each other, they start to imitate each other. Like if I start talking really loud, you might also start talking really loud. Or if I'm gesticulating a lot when I talk, you might do the same thing. So the researchers think, you know, there's got to be a lot more synchronization happening between people's brains when they talk.
Well, how did they test that?
So what they did in this study was they had a graduate student sit in an MRI machine, and this is a machine that measures activity in different parts of your brain. And she related a 15-minute story about her high school days, about boys fighting over her to take her to the prom, and also about a car accident she had. And then what the researchers did was they put 11 volunteers in MRI machines, and they had them listen to this grad student's story. And what they found was that when areas of her brain lit up, when she was talking about certain parts of the story, the same parts of the brain lit up in these volunteers when they were listening to the story. They were actually having the very same parts of their brain turn on, as it were, as the speaker had.
So how do they know that's not because they were just listening to someone talk?
So as a control, the researchers had a person that speaks Russian relate a sort of a similar story, and none of the volunteers could speak Russian. And what they found was that when the volunteers listened to the Russian speaker, their brain regions didn't activate the way they did when they listened to the English speaker.
How long was the delay between some part of the speaker's brain activating and some part of the listener's brain activating?
Well, it really varied. Sometimes the same regions activated at the same time. So if the graduate student was talking about the car accident, maybe a particular part of her brain lit up under MRI. And when a listener heard about the car accident, that same exact part of their brain lit up at the same exact time. But not always. Sometimes, in fact, part of the frontal lobe of these listeners actually lit up right before the frontal lobe of the speaker would have lit up if these guys were actually having a face-to-face conversation. Our researchers say that may indicate that not only are listeners listening to a conversation, but they're actually trying to anticipate what's going to happen next. And by our frontal lobes lighting up, we're sort of predicting what the other speaker is going to say next. And this really all flows into why conversations are so easy for us. You know, we take conversations for granted. You and I are having a conversation right now, but there's actually a lot going on in the brain when this happens. And the researchers say all this mind melding that's going on actually allows us to have an effective conversation. It's not just me talking and you listening, but there's a lot of anticipation going on. There's a lot of me reading signals from you while you're listening. And all this together makes communication and social interaction a lot more pleasant than it probably would be otherwise.
So the next story you brought is about a traffic jam in space. Is that right?
That's right. Lauren, this is all about gridlock that happens in orbit. It turns out that a lot of the satellites, and we've got hundreds of satellites up there orbiting the Earth, a lot of these satellites are in what's called geosynchronous orbit, which means that they are always over the same part of Earth at the same time. And the reason you'd want something like that is if, especially for telecommunication satellites, they have to communicate with satellite dishes on the ground. And we don't always want to be readjusting the satellite dishes on our roof every 2 seconds when the satellite moves. So the idea is we can always point these dishes at the exact same part of the sky, and that satellite's always going to be on that part of the sky because it's in geosynchronous orbit. But it's not easy to get into geosynchronous orbit. In order for satellites to be in this orbit, they actually have to orbit around the equator due to the laws of gravity. And not just around the equator, but actually in a fairly narrow band around the equator. And you can imagine if you've got hundreds of satellites up there and they're all jostling for this very narrow orbital band, there's going to be a lot of traffic and there's going to be a lot of congestion. And we're not there yet where there's total gridlock, but scientists are sort of running out of real estate up there to put these satellites.
So what can we do to make more room?
Well, that's a great question. That's what researchers have been trying to figure out. One idea that's been floated is, well, just put rockets on these satellites that allow them to maneuver into different orbital positions. And the problem with that is if you maneuver outside of this equatorial position, you're in a much less stable orbit, which means you're not just automatically following the same point on Earth all the time. You always have to keep on readjusting to make sure that you're following the same point, and you got to correct your orbit more because this orbit's less stable. And what that means is you're spending a lot more money on rocket fuel. And when these rockets die, the satellite dies. So a solution like that isn't really feasible. It's too expensive and it's not really practical. In this new study, the researchers said, well, can we find something that's a better solution? And they turned to something called solar sails. And the idea is the spacecraft can unfurl these mylar sheaths in space, which sort of act the same way a sail would act on a sailboat on Earth. But instead of catching wind, because there's no wind up there in space, they would actually be catching photons from the sun. And even though these photons are incredibly tiny particles, if you've got enough of them, the idea is that they can actually exert enough force on these mylar sheaths to potentially blow a satellite around. And if you had that, you've got all this natural energy from the sun. You don't need to worry about rockets. You don't need to worry about parts breaking down. All you have to do is have a satellite unfurl its sails and drift into different orbital positions. And the idea is, but maybe by adjusting its sails, the photons would always keep on blowing, for lack of a better word, to keep that satellite in that position so it wouldn't drift into a less stable orbit.
Well, can they actually do this yet?
Well, there's actually a Japanese spacecraft called Icarus, which is testing the solar sail idea right now. It actually unfurled its sail a few weeks ago. But everything the researchers are proposing in this study is all theoretical. They based it on some very complicated mathematical formulas. And actually, this idea had been proposed by a scientist a while back, but he didn't have the sophisticated computer tools to prove that this idea would actually work. And that's what researchers are doing in this study. They're showing that not only was this a good idea, but it's actually practical.
So what could technology like this be used for?
Well, in addition to alleviating some of the congestion around the Earth's equator, researchers say if we can put these geosynchronous satellites in different places around the planet, which hasn't been possible before, you can imagine putting a geosynchronous satellite above the poles, for example, to measure climate change, and it would always be trained at the same spot. And the idea is that you could get a very accurate reading of a specific part of the planet, say maybe a slice of Antarctica, that you wouldn't be able to get as easily with other satellites.
And our last story is about rubber bands and how they roll. And I'm wondering, how on earth do you get a rubber band to roll?
Well, that's a really good question. And actually, the researchers used something a bit like a hamster wheel. They had this large metal cylinder that spun around, almost like an oil barrel rolling down a hill, but it stayed in one place. So you got this barrel sort of rolling around. They stuck the rubber band inside and increased the speed.
And why were they doing this?
Also, another very good question. The idea is that, you know, physicists have solved a lot of problems, going all the way back to Galileo, when he rolled a bronze ball down a hill and figured out all the forces that act on this ball to increase its acceleration and everything like that. But balls are pretty easy objects. The physics gets a lot more complicated when you're dealing with so-called elastic objects. These are objects that, as the name implies, they're much more flexible.
Well, why would we want to know what happens to an elastic object?
Well, the reason is because there's a lot of phenomena that involve elastic objects. You could be talking about anything from how volcano lava might flow on Mars to that inflatable emergency exit raft on airplanes. There's just so many things that we deal with and that physicists are curious about that aren't as simple as a ball rolling down a hill.
Okay, so what did they find when they put the rubber band in the drum and set it rolling?
And you can actually see a video of that on the site. What they found was that the faster the rubber band rolled, the more it started to compress. All these forces that keep a rubber band rolling, forces like centrifugal forces and the stiffness of the rubber band and even the effects of gravity, all these things sort of act on the rubber band while it's rolling around. What the researchers found is the faster it rolls, all these other forces actually overwhelm gravity, and the rubber band starts to collapse in on itself. And you can see this in the video. In fact, the rubber band can collapse so much that it starts touching itself, and it can fly right off the wheel. But what the researchers were trying to do is, well, first of all, they found that out. But then the researchers actually developed a model to explain everything that was going on with the rubber band. And that's really what experts say is the interesting part of the study. They say, yeah, it's fun to watch a rubber band roll in a tube, and it's kind of cool to see what would happen if you made a rubber band essentially roll down a hill very quickly. But what's really important here, they say, is this model that's describing what's happening, because they say that they can use this model to describe some of the things we were talking about earlier. In fact, one of the researchers says that he can imagine designing a car that the faster it goes, the more it deforms and the less friction it would have with the air. And you can imagine a car getting even more aerodynamic as it goes faster. It's pretty far in the future, but at least models like this allow physicists to envision these kinds of things, which they really didn't have the formulas to describe before.
So what other stories are you looking into this week?
Well, Lauren, we've got stories about how smoking marijuana distorts time. People who smoke pot tend to sometimes say that they feel lost in time, and researchers have figured out potentially what's going on, and also a story about ancient viruses hiding out in our DNA. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about a data leak that happened earlier this week that revealed that there may be a lot more Earth-like planets out there than we previously thought. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Lauren.
Science news reporter Lauren Schenkman talked with online news editor David Grimm. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the July 30th, 2010 edition of the Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai, Dolly Krishnaswamy, and Lauren Schenkman for contributions to the show this week. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.